The Minnesota Finns, history, culture, and legacy.
They were the one group, although they had a lot of help from the South Slavs and the Italians and other groups, but it was primarily the Finns who were the leaders of the strikes and of the agitation for economic justice. There's no doubt about that.
Pam Brunfeld is an Iron Range historian.
The ore on the Mesabi was found in 1890, and the first shipment of ore left the Mesabi Iron Range on October 12, 1892. I've begun to say that it's one of the most important dates in American history. The ore from the Mesabi Iron Range was so valuable that the industrialization of the United States literally occurred because of it. Up until the time of the discovery of the Mesabi Iron Range, this country could not produce the amount of iron and, by consequence, then steel that it would have needed to industrialize this country. The New York skyline, the Chicago skyline, the San Francisco skyline, any of the big cities in this country would not look like they do today without Mesabi iron ore. I argue that we would neither have become a world power nor the industrial economic giant that we became without the iron ore that's in the ground here. And it was the people of the Iron Range who made that possible.
July 20th, 1907, thousands of miners walked off the job on the Mesabi Iron Range of northeast Minnesota. The 1907 Mesabi Range Strike would be the first organized strike in range history, and it would largely be populated and led by the Finnish immigrants, whose American dream of land ownership and freedom had been trampled in the red dust of iron mining country. They couldn't change a corrupt and unfair system overnight, but they could invite the unions onto the range, and they could strike.
Part of the big picture is work in the United States was changing in the late 19th and early 20th century, changing from being primarily skilled work done by artisans in relatively individual settings to becoming increasingly unskilled and mechanized work.
As a professor at McAllister College in St. Paul, Peter Ratcliffe specializes in labor and immigrant history.
The workforce was changing. After 1880 or so, large numbers of immigrants were coming to the United States, mostly from Southern and Eastern Europe, but also from Finland, coming to take these unskilled jobs, which were often dangerous, mining jobs, meatpacking jobs, steel mill jobs. They were dangerous. They were low paid. That's what Minnesota's Iron Range was like in the period from when it opened in the early 1890s. Because the majority of these communities across the industrial frontier were unincorporated communities. People didn't have the right to vote. They were kind of like internal colonies. And immigrants came and were plunked down there and put to work. And many of them died and many of them were injured and got no kind of benefits or security. It was a very, very harsh lifestyle. In the case of the mines, a very big issue was the way the workers were paid. And they were paid on what was called the contract system. And that is, they were paid by the amount of iron that each worker could pick and shovel out of the mine in the course of a day.
Iron Range historian Pam Brunfeld.
They never knew what their pay was going to be from month to month. They had to pay for their candles, they had to pay for their blasting caps, they had to pay for their dynamite, they had to pay for broken tools, they had to pay for the drill bits. They didn't get paid unless they were mining. If they were putting up supports in the underground mines to keep them safe, they weren't paid while they were building the roof supports. If they were known to be activists, labor activists, they were given bad places in the mine where there was low ore or there was hard rock. The captains in the mine were often hated because they would engage in forms of extortion. If the miners wanted a good place in the mine, they sometimes had to pay a bribe or a kickback.
Fed up with conditions, in 1905, the Finnish miners invited the Western Federation of Miners to the range to organize labor unions. Miners were slow to adopt the fairly recent and unfamiliar concept of a labor union, but slowly the numbers began to rise. Still, they were in no position yet to stand against the steel trust, but a dock worker strike in Duluth, where the mined ore was shipped, forced layoffs on the range, and the Oliver Mining Company chose this occasion to retaliate by laying off 200 miners known to be union members. The next day, the Western Federation of Miners called a strike. Many of the leaders who walked mine to mine, urging men to join, were Finns.
It was one of the reasons why they were often persecuted, both by the companies and by people here in the area. The elites in the area didn't like the Finns much because they weren't compliant and they couldn't control them.
Peter Ratcliffe.
The Finns came out of a very interesting geopolitical environment. Immigration historians often argue about, did immigrants become socialists and militant trade unionists and even communists because of the conditions they faced, or did they bring those ideas with them? And in the case of the Finns, they brought a good share of those ideas with them, and then the conditions that they lived in convinced them.
The mining companies responded to the strike by appointing deputies, buying and distributing rifles, using their deep pockets to import hired guns from the East. Governor Johnny Johnson was even asked to send National Guard troops. Mining companies, miners, and range citizens brace themselves for a bloody feud like the labor struggles reported in other parts of a pre-unionized America. But the governor declined to send his troops, and the mining company's solution was already stepping off the trains.
Given the nature of the global economy, because there was a global economy 100 years ago, just like there's one today, it's not a new invention today, that political and economic change was happening in other parts of the world in the early 20th century. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was in the throes of internal revolt and ethnic hostilities and challenges to the Archduke. And as a result, companies like Oliver Mining and the United States Steel Company were able to recruit workers from Croatia, from Serbia, from all these places to come and take the jobs that the Finns had been holding and now had gone on strike. It's very interesting to see what happens after the strike is defeated in 1907. And in many cases, these miners were blacklisted. They were fired and blacklisted for participating in the strike in 1907. Many of the Finns decide they're going to stay. They're not able to get a job back in the mines because of the ecological disaster that was the timber industry. Large parts of the forest in the Iron Range and across northern Minnesota had been clear cut. And so here was this relatively crappy land, but it had been cleared. Here were these way too short growing seasons. I mean, what in the world are you really going to be able to do as a farmer? And they said they're going to stick around and they're going to agitate the strike breakers. And so they're going to try to radicalize the Croatians and the Serbs and the Slovenes and all of these other groups. And of course, management would end up doing a very good job of radicalizing those workers by sticking them in the same miserable working conditions, by denying them the same rights to free speech and political expression. And 9 years later, in 1916, there would be an even bigger strike across all the Iron Ranges, not just the Mesabi. And it would be over the very same issues that the 1907 strike had been about. And there would be major organizing projects during the 1930s. A tremendous change in people's lives.
Professor at McAllister College in St. Paul, Peter Ratcliffe. This is Britt Amit for KAXE, KBXE, where programs like the Minnesota Finns are made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.